Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. April 4th, 1968, a shot rang out in a Memphis sky. Remember that U2 song, Sunday Bloody Sunday? Bono got the time of day wrong, not morning, 6 p.m., but that is indeed on this day when the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Wonder if the feds will ever fess up to that one like they did with JFK. More on that in my quotes of the day. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest Paul Bradley. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcast and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Paul Bradley. Get Hedge was founded in April 2021 by David Schwartz and Paul Bradley. Last year, the Nashville-based startup received pre-seed investments from Charlie Lee, the creator of Litecoin, and the founders of Block Bank, a cryptocurrency app. Prior to starting GetHedge, Bradley, a Nashville native, spent 25 years in the banking and fintech sectors, developing transaction software and structures prior to joining forces with Schwartz and founding GetHedge. GetHedge is proud to be a part of the stories of these professional athletes, Bradley says. However, we want people to know that you don't have to be a professional athlete to use GetHedge. GetHedge can be used by anyone who receives a paycheck. GetHedge announced a partnership with GetPayroll to further enhance the first ever cryptocurrency payroll program between a traditional payroll service and cryptocurrency fintech companies. Both GetHedge and its new partner, GetPayroll, are veteran-owned companies. GetHedge operating between banks and banking-grade digital assets. Paul, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Thank you for coming on to discuss cryptocurrency and hopefully some about your company, GetHedge.io. But first, tell us how you got interested in the space and what you like about working in it.
Well, crypto was nothing I set out to be involved with. I've been in fintechs and banking and what they call complicated mass payment, which overseas, cross-border, any kind of payroll, mass distributions, a large B2B payment type of companies. So that's my background. I have several successful fintechs. I'm in the BlackRock portfolio. My banking profession's pretty great. So Why would I do something crazy, like completely leave it, walk away and never look back? It's because Bitcoin represents such a unique application of a parallel banking system from a true peer-to-peer. It's a little bit technical, but the decentralized aspects and the fact that I continued to spot check it and do my research over a long period of time, there was a critical mass where I couldn't ignore it anymore. I did a project with the bank. The bank said, we'll let you do it, but we don't support you. And if you do it, that's the end of our relationship. And I went ahead and agreed with them and built my first blockchain process, and the rest is history.
Wow. Are you married with kids?
I am in a relationship with kids for many, many years. I'm an older guy, but I have found my equilibrium and my happiness.
Awesome. Okay. So we had someone else on recently, CEO of StaxPay, Scott Pranger, also Nashville, actually episode 69. So folks can go back and hear us talk about the recent FTX scandals and a little about the mechanics of Bitcoin and exchanges and wallets, etc. So I'm just knowledgeable enough now to be dangerous. But tell us again, Paul, it was Aristotle, who was the ancient Greek philosopher, student of Plato and teacher of Alexander the Great, most influential Western philosopher, who basically said what money is. And we've been working on that ever since. Number one, durable. It must not be easily destroyed. Two, portable. It must be easy to carry around. Three, divisible, such that the parts yielded by the division would be interchangeable. And four, relatively rare and intrinsically valuable. So according to Aristotle's first characteristics of good money, currency is not durable because it could easily be destroyed, for example, by fire. And while it is readily portable, currency is also not divisible, such that division would yield two interchangeable parts, Splitting a 10-euro note down the middle does not produce 2 5-euro notes. Additionally, currency is not rare and intrinsically valuable, as you can easily print or mint more of it in virtually unlimited quantities, as our Fed does. Therefore, it can be said that neither the euro, the dollar, nor any other form of currency is, quote, good money. Crude oil, natural gas, real estate, although crude oil is mostly durable, visible, and relatively limited in quantity, it is not easily portable. The same applies to natural gas. Real estate, however, is the worst of the three because it can in no way be carried around. Dividing it would also pose quite the challenge, because how could you split a piece of property with a stretch of river in one corner and a dense forest in the other into three equal parts? How do you divide a house into 10 parts? Therefore, none of the above are particularly good form of money either. Okay, how does cryptocurrency relate to all that?
Well, you would have to say that Bitcoin is money. And so I'm not sure that I'm there yet. Okay, so Bitcoin to me is a digital asset. All right, so not unlike gold, except you can't email gold. There's a finite amount of it. It's decentralized. Some cryptocurrency like Litecoin has fungibility to it, to where you can't easily say, like a piece of gold, a coin is a coin is a coin is a coin. But in crypto, you can block a digital Bitcoin and it's scarred, it's flagged for life. It's been in a bad actor's hand. So it's not a perfect currency or money, but what it is, it's a backbone, almost like the internet today and the trunk lines of the internet. The internet is controlled by a handful of individual people or companies. Think of Comcast, think of Apple, think of Google, where you can have this backbone of Bitcoin and Ethereum and be able to build money platforms, contracts, really, on top of those, where it's engineered, it's an engineered asset. So it's not quite money yet. It's very volatile and it moves around a lot. But over a 4-year period, it goes up dramatically. Whereas over, it used to be a 10 or 20-year period of US dollar, it would lose its value over time. Bitcoin's the opposite. There are fewer coming into the market and it's a finite resource. So there's growth involved in Bitcoin. But I disagree that it's a good currency, because if I were to say, I'm going to give you the equivalent of $10,000 a year or a month, let's just use a year, to do a task for me, and you budgeted that $10,000 and you needed that $10,000, and I give you a Bitcoin worth whatever that day is, $10,000, but in 3 weeks it's worth 20% less. That's not a good currency to be so volatile within that ecosystem. So I wouldn't say it's a currency.
Okay. So intrinsic value, which is perhaps the most important characteristic of financial assets, is that their price can vary enormously with the attitudes of investors. Put simply, there are two main factors that determine the price of a financial asset. One, the credibility or strength of the underlying promise, which will depend on the future cash flows generated by the asset, as you said, and its transferability or popularity with the market. That is, how many other investors are interested in buying the asset. In the process known as price discovery, investors' assets, they assess these factors based on the information available to them and then make bids to buy or sell the asset, which in turn sets its price on the market, like a stock or a bond or a mutual fund, net asset value, et cetera, et cetera.
Demand.
How does cryptocurrency have an intrinsic value when it's so volatile?
I think the intrinsic value that it has is that it's decentralized. And no one entity controls it, and that it's transparent. It has one ledger everyone can see. So the fact that nobody is pulling the strings and everyone can see the transactions and agree on the transactions, that is something we don't have in society today. So decentralization, visibility, and then the engineered piece of every 4 years there is less of it coming into the system. So I think those are the core pieces that define it. So why are they important, right? Decentralization. Okay. So what? Governments have always issued money because they typically are the ones who can enforce it, who can issue it, who can bring it to its fruition. This is the first time we've never had to have an intermediary. So a bank or a government or a lawyer who is between you and me, when you and I go to settle a transaction, I can do it directly with you, peer to peer, have that transaction authorized, have it all set, end up in your wallet. And that transaction is unlike a digital transaction. So if I gave you a credit card for that, you could walk away and I could dispute it. I could bring fraud into the equation. The banks and the consumer protection laws, will make sure I get that money back. It will come out of your pocket and end up back in my pocket. So Bitcoin is more like a cash transaction. It's permanent and finite. Once that transaction has been completed, I can never claw it back. So that's an important piece of this. It's not run by a government. Everyone can see it. Everyone plays by the same rules and laws. Already, it doesn't sound like our money system, right? It is. Right. It's vastly different. So it is of the people. That's really what I love about it. And there's no funny business happening.
So banks run under this magical formula called fractional reserve banking. Mm-hmm. You take a deposit to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, any name you've ever heard of, you deposit it for $100, you get a statement that says, thank you for your $100. They turn around and they leverage that sometimes 10, sometimes in the Lehman Brothers case, 40 times then turn around and lend to build really big houses or really big skyscrapers or whatever they want to do with your money while it's sitting there, especially if it's in a term deposit and they know when they have to give it back potentially. Can that also be done with a cryptocurrency where somebody says, I have maybe an exchange. I take in $10,000 worth of cryptocurrency. I will now turn around and make 100,000 fresh currencies out of it and buy a bungalow in Eastern Europe. Can they do what we call fractional reserve with cryptocurrency?
I think the short answer is they can do anything they want. They can try it. Will it be successful? That should be the question. Can someone successfully take a fractional reserve banking and then take the rest of your funds and apply it somewhere else? We saw that in the last market, 2021, companies like Celsius and Voyager that went out and attempted to do this. And it was riddled with fraud. It was riddled with greed. It was riddled with all the human emotions that mess up a system, right? It was no longer engineered. It was, hey, how much money can we really make? And then they took licensing and they did some things that were just bad direction. So I would say that fractional reserve Bitcoin would end very similarly without as fractional reserve banking, but it doesn't have the backstop of the government's protection. It's a bad idea. But there have been legitimate banking experts. Caitlin Long, I believe is her name, out of Wyoming, that have spent years creating banking and digital banking applications that could apply to everyday consumers and banking. Her thought was, let's keep 108% of our reserves on file because everything's so liquid. So she worked with regulators for several years, at least 3 years, worked with the state, worked with federal regulators, lawyers, lobbyists, the whole piece, did everything they told her to do, had 110% reserves, banking license was denied. So the U.S. government likes their system, and that's the system that they want us to use.
Right. I want to get into that a little bit and how it's kind of a mousetrap, but If you do take that banking route and that fractional reserve banking, you also have the ability to borrow, to loan against it, which creates artificial money as well. And some things have a loan to value of 80%, let's say a tax-free municipal bond or a U.S. Treasury. versus say cash or money market, which has very high as well, versus like a very aggressive stock, like a biotech stock or a penny stock, you wouldn't get any leverage. But could cryptocurrency ever get to a situation where you're lending $1 million of cryptocurrency in order to get $850,000 worth of debt to then turn around and reinvest in something else? Or because of the blockchain or the exchanges, would that be unfeasible?
Well, I think you would use the blockchain as an asset, and then modern tools of puts and calls and derivatives, you can apply that to anything. So I think they're out there trying it, using it, trying to apply this, the old methodology to the new methodology, and just see how far they can take it. But these are two completely different languages. So we haven't seen that that works. I'm not a finance guy to where I need to have all these derivatives. I deal in a whole Bitcoin or the whole cryptocurrencies myself. So I don't go off script and do that. But are people, there will always be bankers and finance people who want more, who have figured out a new way to get more of a scrape, or it's all about yield. So is that possible? Absolutely.
It seems more like gold, like you said, or silver on a smaller scale, the 20 to 1 ratio right now of price, where you would say, I can't lend my gold at a debt. You could, I suppose, if somebody was willing to take that opportunity, but you can't borrow it as on margin, let's say, to buy it. Cryptocurrency doesn't have the ability, or at least doesn't exist yet. And of course, it's a competitor to banks where they have cash and they have CDs. So there's going to be some friction there, what they're willing to do. But cryptocurrency, it is real. The notable example is Bitcoin. That's the one that most people affiliate with. But there actually are differences. So it's a relatively new type of alternative currency. Kind of early to say whether wider society is going to catch on with it. You can't pay your taxes with it. You can't pay your life insurance with it. You can't pay your car insurance with it yet. You could. Well, but don't you have to convert it to whatever currency that is accepted, like US dollars? And that could very well be a taxable event. If you bought it for $10,000, it swung up to $30,000. You liquidate it enough to pay taxes and boom, you just had to capital
gain. Yeah, no, from that standpoint, you are correct. But there are plenty of mechanisms in the financial market where I can put in, if I owe $10,000 of taxes, I can pay the equivalent of $10,000 in Bitcoin, and it goes and settles my tax bill. So it is switched back to US dollar in the background. The government's not holding your Bitcoin, but it is a payment channel, payment vehicle.
Okay. But it is, as we said, relatively difficult to measure the durability of a cryptocurrency. But when compared to conventional currencies like the euro or the dollar or the Swiss franc, et cetera, it has a clear advantage. As long as there are at least two computers in the world with a blockchain database, cryptocurrency transactions can technically be made, right? I got that right from your website. As currencies like Bitcoin are digital, they're also readily portable, like we talked about from Aristotle. And dividing a cryptocurrency does actually produce two interchangeable parts. A cryptocurrency can be split into two equally valuable halves. Due to the high volatility, however, it is not yet possible to say whether cryptocurrencies have an intrinsic value. Only time will tell. That's why the price discovery has been so off the charts, right? Yeah. Okay, so and for the last several thousand years, gold and silver have been regarded as the archetypes of real good money. Before money existed, goods were traded through bartering, a direct transaction where goods and services are exchanged without using money. Eventually, to make trading more convenient, gold coins were introduced as a form of money. Do you think gold and even barter, compared to the two computers left on Earth to actually do a transaction, have a role in this as well? Or is cryptocurrency actually the replacement of all of these exchanges of value?
So to be determined. However, I was on a call today where you're starting to see the realities of the world and the utilities of the world kind of merge. So these guys were concerned about keeping a large amount of dollars or a large amount of their company's treasury in dollars. They were moving to what they said were cryptocurrencies. So I asked, is that Bitcoin? Is that a stable coin? meaning pegged to the US dollar, so there's no volatility. And their answer was they're moving more to a commodities-based platform where it's crypto is backed by gold and commodities in a pool, and the crypto represents the ability to divide those assets. So you can have the portability of gold and cross borders and send it and email it through the blockchain, where essentially it's what it used to be back in the 60s. You could take your dollar to a bank and get your gold out of it. So that was an interesting project. So it is tied to a treasury, it's tied to commodities and tied to gold and silver itself. And if you wanted
to- So you're talking about like the Federal Reserve note used to be convertible into a set amount of gold. I think it was gold, not silver. Maybe it was silver. Gold. Okay. So you walk into a bank, you say, here's my piece of paper, give me my gold. Then they severed that. Richard Nixon did, I'm pretty sure, if not FDR.
France wanted their gold.
France said,
we'd like our gold, please.
Yeah. But I think FDR had done it even prior, but it was still tradable. And then Nixon said no more. So 50 years later, gold and silver are durable. They have that quality. They can't be destroyed. If your house catches on fire, maybe get a little singed, but not destroyed. Or if you actually accidentally put them through the spin cycle, they're not going to rust away. They are portable. As you said, you can divide it into interchangeable and valuable parts. You could break a 1 gram gold bar in half. You now have half a gram of gold, two gold bars. Gold and silver are also rare because they're limited in quantity and cannot easily be reproduced, printed. They can be at the Federal Reserve, but I can't do it. And precious metals are considered to have intrinsic value because they have preserved their value over hundreds and even thousands of years. Cryptocurrency obviously doesn't have the hundreds and thousands of years, but it can be printed and diluted, can't it?
Some can. Like you and I could sit down and engineer a cryptocurrency and bring it to fruition probably by this evening. Okay, so technologically, all those components would be there. We can even go to Bitcoin Core and just split it and have our own Bitcoin. But it's not Bitcoin, it's just the code. So a key piece of this is the liquidity. It is the market share that it demands. That's one of the reasons Bitcoin is the leader. It has so much liquidity and so much market cap. If you want to go sell your Bitcoin today at any exchange, there's going to be somebody there to buy it, and you'll get a good exchange. You go take the coin we make, and it goes up to $100 a coin. And by the time we go to cash it out, there's been a rug pull, there's no money left, and we're stuck in the system. So cryptocurrency is not a get rich quick overnight. You know, let's sell our house, let's take all of our assets, put into Bitcoin, and in a couple of months we'll 10x it, we'll be so rich. It's a dangerous ploy. So you don't work it that way. Yeah. I stick to the blue chips. The get hedge services are typically Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, and a USDC, which is a stable coin.
The way you just described it very much reminds me when I was young in my investment business with penny stocks, where you would buy, and then you turn around to sell, and to who? There was no price on the other side. Explain, you mentioned a few buzzwords out there, and I kind of get them, but maybe some other people don't. But explain mining, blockchain, and if you would, what an exchange like FTX is actually for.
Okay, let me start with the mining piece. The mining piece is a shoebox size, literally it's about a shoebox, of a piece of hardware that is the core of your CPU computer. So everybody who's worked in an office has had a tower or a desktop computer. If you were to go into that desktop computer and take out the motherboard and all the pieces that really just crank data and then stack them on top of each other to maximize its potential, that's essentially what one of these miners is. It's a cut through piece of computer that really does one piece really well. And so the mining is decentralized. Everybody's got these shoeboxes. Some mining pools have walls of them, but essentially you got a shoebox size that could be in your basement. It could be in your attic. It could be in your vacation property. Some Teslas have them in their cars, right? So it requires electricity. It churns through it. It sounds like a little portable heater, just grinding away. And what it's doing is it is viably trying to authorize pieces of the blockchain to authorize it. And it's the autonomous piece that happens. So every time you helped that and you helped that mining process, you get a tiny little piece of Bitcoin as a reward. So that's why people get excited about mining, because you can actually create Bitcoin by providing a service. And that usually costs some hardware and then whatever your electric bill is. And then you have a piece of some Bitcoin. That's how it originally enters into the market. It's created and rewarded to someone's computer, what they did on their computer. And then they can take that as a reward and go get money to pay for their electricity and so forth. So once you get that piece of Bitcoin, you now need to pay your electric bill. And so traditionally you have over the counter, so I can go to you directly and say, will you trade me this? But there are legal issues there that most people don't want to. They're not traders, and there are legal pieces of that. So you can go to an exchange, which is Coinbase is an exchange. It's a website. You can give your Bitcoin to a wallet on that designated to you. You can sell it. You can trade it. You can exchange it. It's what it is. That's the exchange. Exchange it for dollars. You can exchange it for euros. You can exchange it for Ethereum or different cryptocurrencies. You can exchange it for a stable coin where it's a digital version of a dollar that just stays in the blockchain. So that's what an exchange is. And let me go one more piece and say an exchange is a website. Okay. One of the true pieces of the technology of blockchain is that you can self-custody your own money in your own wallet, right? In your name that no one else can touch. It's like a bank account that you keep at your house that the bank has to call you and ask permission to authorize it or access it. When you put your money on an exchange, you give up your rights to your money and you put it in their wallet and they have control over it. You can trade it and use it. But once you are on an exchange, that's a very vulnerable place for you to be. It's an unregulated Wild West. Do your business, get back to your own wallet. That's the way it should be done. All those people that got hurt on FTX didn't really understand or got greedy or just basically did what everybody at SVB did. They got lazy. They got lazy and they got burned.
Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah. So that's fascinating. So when we think of mining for money, you think of the 49ers back in the California gold rush out there in pans and picks and in the rivers, you know, getting their little nugget. And then of course you think of an exchange like the New York Stock Exchange where everybody's screaming and yelling, or if you saw Trading Places in Chicago, you know, doing that over commodities and buy, sell gives you that actual price. But you just described mining of turning nothing into something and exchanges being a risky place where you could have your money walk out the door without your knowledge, as FTX took advantage of and did. Yes. Because it doesn't have what money needs to have if it's a currency note, which is the full faith and credit of the let's say in this case the Federal Reserve of America or the taxpayers to back it up. What gives the value of a mine chip, and why does Bitcoin have such a six-figure price versus like Dogecoin that I think has a $1,000 price? Why aren't they at par?
That's a great question. So the original coins that are issued, I think Bitcoin is capped at 21 million. All right. So they're not even enough Bitcoin for every millionaire in the world to own a Bitcoin. So that's a finite resource. That alone should show some value. If all those millionaires wanted a Bitcoin, which I believe they eventually will, that drives the price. It's supply and demand. Where you have a Dogecoin that is also mined and is decentralized, but there are billions and billions of them. It'll stay in the pennies range, and that there's value there. So if I need to buy some Doge and buy a cup of coffee, I'm not going to take huge swings in price action because there's so many of them.
A little bit like the gold and silver disparity, where there's more silver on Earth, and so it's worth less, and you can buy coffee with it versus a house.
You would hold Bitcoin, but if you wanted to go and buy some coffee, you trade into some Dogecoin. The Dogecoin transactions happen a lot faster. They're easier on a consumer commerce level. Bitcoin, I think, is an 8-minute transaction. You're never going to go somewhere and wait for 8 minutes for your transaction to go through. So there's a hierarchy there. So the Bitcoin, because it is so difficult and the original one and so much liquidity there, people tend to build on top of it because it is a computer language after all. And you can build ways to interact and move funds. And so that's the argument / conversation in the market now. There are 20,000 assets out there. Do we need them or do we need just one or two? So that's where we are in the market. And that's the speculative piece of it.
Interesting. Okay. So M0, I'm going to get a little glazed over eyes, probably. Hopefully they're not driving too fast. Referred to as the monetary base, M0 includes all the money in circulation, including money banks hold in reserve. According to the Federal Reserve, there was about $2.3 trillion in circulation as of January of this year. M1, it includes all the M0 money supply, $2.3 trillion, adding the money held in traveler's checks, demand deposits, other types of checkable deposits, and negotiable orders of withdrawal as of January 2023. The seasonally adjusted stock of M1 totaled $19.64 trillion, quite a bit more than M0. M2, it includes all the currency from the M1 money supply and expands to include mutual funds, smaller time deposits, mutual funds, smaller time deposits, money market securities, and other types of time deposits. M2 currencies are usually less liquid than M1, meaning you can't convert M2 money into cash as easily. So the total stock of M2 was $21.27 trillion in January. Bear with me 1 second. Total value of notes and coins in circulation, the Bank of International Settlements estimated to be $8.28 trillion US dollars across 20 major countries plus the euro area in 2021. There are nearly 200 countries in the world, so this is just a rough estimate. The global M1 supply, which includes all the money in circulation plus traveler's checks and demand deposits like checking and savings accounts, was $48.9 trillion as of November 28th, 2022, according to Visual Capitalist. That publication estimates the total value of the M2 supply to be $82.6 trillion. So I don't want to read too much more without having you give it some input, but where does Bitcoin fit into that $82.6 trillion supply of whatever it is, wealth?
Well, it's a part of it, and it is an asset and it's a commodity. So that's technically the hierarchy of how that works. The numbers you just read were tremendously large. Tens of trillions of dollars. That number was 30 years ago, wasn't even close to that. So what you're seeing is an expansion of the M1 policies, right? M2, it's just getting larger and larger and larger. So where does that fit in? Your interest rates, there are issues in our system that are buckling, and I won't go through them all, but it begins with trust. The trust is beginning to buckle a little bit. There's inflation. There are interest rates. There are all these pieces that are what our banking system is today. I would argue that Bitcoin is represented in that figure, but it is not encompassing of that figure from the sense that this is a new language, it's a new paradigm, and it is a parallel banking system not to be confused with the one we have today. So it is an alternative banking system that starts out really high in numbers. I think the first Bitcoin transaction was 10,000 Bitcoin to buy a pizza. That guy wishes he had his 10,000. Maybe it was a delicious pizza. I'm going to go with it's a delicious pizza. But I can't help but think that my mom and dad and grandparents would tell me about how they'd go spend the Saturday picking up coat hangers and go and see a movie and buy some popcorn for 16 cents. Now you can get a ticket for $20. That's, I don't know how many times that is. It's more than 100 times. So our money's headed in the wrong direction. Staying in cash and protecting your money and having a piggy bank and protecting your family is being diluted. We now have to go and borrow money from a bank just to stay whole. We have to take our piggy bank and put it into the market or it goes away. That's what we're talking about here. Interest rates, I do not believe, will continue to just go up to stomp out inflation. Other things are beginning to break. The Fed are starting to print more money for backstops of banks to give people confidence. But all that money circulating around is what the interest rates are trying to drive away. So the Fed is in a pickle. The government is in a pickle. You've got inflation. You have interest rates. But what has happened, and I'm sure your viewers know this, is that as interest rates have stepped up so quickly, it has left a void in the banks that they cannot compete. So people have taken $850 billion out in the last 12 months of U.S. banking deposits, and they're chasing yield with it that the banks can never give them. So that yield is also part of the Bitcoin community because people are making money. You're growing over time your assets in Bitcoin. So there's so many moving pieces to this. It's hard to just say, here's your answer. But is it a part of it? Yes. Is it an alternative part of it? Yes. Is it a place that can protect you? Is Bitcoin a help to an American citizen if they start to have inflation and more money comes into this and are deficits will never be bought down? You bet it is. To have an asset.
Do you know what the market cap of Bitcoins and all the alternatives are approximately right now of that 82 trillion?
I do not know. It would be in the $1 trillion range or high billions, but it is a representing the possibilities of what it could be. It's in its very early stages.
Yeah. And, you know, money is also present in the form of investments and derivatives, and the total market capitalization of just the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ is over $48 trillion as of December 2022. According to Statista, the market cap of cryptocurrency, as reported by CoinMarketCap, and your guess is as good as theirs probably, is adds another $1.07 trillion to that figure. So let me switch gears real quick. We only have a few more minutes left. A reserve currency is a large amount of currency held by central banks and major financial institutions to use for international transaction. A reserve currency reduces exchange rate risk since there's no need for a country to exchange its currency for the reserve currency to do trade. Reserve currency helps facilitate global transactions, including investments and international debt obligations. A large percentage of commodities are priced in the reserve currency, causing countries to hold this currency to pay for their goods. In the year 1900, the US dollar and pound sterling made up 0% and 60% of global reserves, respectively. So the dollar was nothing, the pound sterling was more than half. But fast forward to 2020, the pound now represents just 4.7%, less than 5%, of global currency reserves, while the US dollar stands at nearly 60%. So they totally reverse roles. World reserve currency, with China pushing to institute the yuan as a new world reserve currency, linking deals with Brazil and India, more than 65 countries pegged their currencies to the U.S. dollar. Around 90% of all Forex trades involve the U.S. dollar. Where does Bitcoin fit in globally?
Well, that's a good question. The U.S. dollar, so there's some that, that's a good question. You stumped me with that one.
I got another one after that. So
the Bitcoin continues to grow and provide yield and growth alternatives in a world that yield is diminishing. So I'll just stop there before I just ramble, because I want to get on to your next question. But
okay, so you say it has a potential to be a real viable competitor to those, let's say, to the U.S. dollar's 60% world reserve currency and what used to be the U.K. So the U.S. dollar is not going to be there forever. It could be dethroned, and you think maybe cryptocurrency could be it.
Potentially, but the U.S. is, if you think of our economy currently as a big steamship out in the ocean, one of our engines is broken, right? But we have two more, and none of the passengers have really noticed that we've slowed down a little bit. So even if all the engines went, we're going to maintain this forward momentum. I think 85% of the world's debt, sovereign debts, are still settled in USD. Accounts receivables are held in USD. It just doesn't go away overnight. So yeah, the notion that you could, sovereign nations could settle debts in Bitcoin is there, but I don't know how that would work as it is today.
Okay. So my next one, my last one, unfortunately, is petrodollars. The term petrodollar refers to the money received from the sale of oil, obviously. Coined in the 70s, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. have traded with it since the 70s. On January 17th, the Saudi finance minister, Mohammed al-Jadan, announced that the Saudi state is open to selling oil in currencies other than the dollar. There are no issues with discussing how we settle our trade arrangements, whether it is in the U.S. dollar, whether it is in the euro, whether it is in the Saudi rial, Al-Jadan told Bloomberg TV. Can Bitcoin dethrone the petrodollar exchange? And then one last part of that, one estimate puts euro dollar assets at around 12 trillion. For context, we can consider that all assets in U.S. banks total about 22 trillion. Put another way, offshore dollar banking now amounts to about half of the U.S. total. Goldman Sachs has warned that the U.S. dollar faces risks that could erode its global dominance, saying it's dealing with some of the same exchanges that British pound faced in the early 1900s. The move by the U.S. and its allies to freeze Russia's central bank out of much of its foreign currency reserves has raised concerns that countries could start moving away from it using the U.S. dollar due to worries about the power the currency grants the U.S. Coordinated attack on the dollar, Saudi Arabia, China, India, even small Malaysia. Dollar hegemony is in trouble. Inflation, restrict production in oil and gas. Dollar looks very vulnerable. Even the Kenyan president said so. Could cryptocurrency be that replacement?
The short answer is yes. It's an asset-based, it's an instant transaction. If two sovereign nations agree that it's valuable, yes.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much for a fascinating discussion, Paul. With all that said, would you let your kids invest their life savings in crypto?
Oh, I do. They absolutely. And I have portfolios for all my kids. I teach them. I don't want them to put everything in there, but they'd be naive not to have exposure.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you very much. We do appreciate you. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you, your company, what your company does in the last minute or so, and your social media.
Oh, I appreciate that. You can go to GetHedge, GetHedge.com, and that's where you can find the product. The product is essentially what we found to be the safest way to protect a consumer, which I'm a consumer. It's just you and I are consumers, to purchase and get some exposure to Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, or USDC, which is the stable coin. It comes directly out of your paycheck. So it eliminates the fraud in the system, right? So we know the paycheck providers, it's for U.S. residents. I take 10% of my paycheck, it goes into Bitcoin. I get it that day in my own wallet. I set it up once and it's fire and forget. So it's a way to get a portion of your pay in cryptocurrency. The strategy is dollar cost averaging. And I encourage you to go do your research on Bitcoin and dollar cost averaging. That's the choice that I made for myself. And then you can find me online at LinkedIn or Twitter. I'm at Satoshi South. And my name's Paul Bradley with GetHedge. And it's been a pleasure to be here with you today.
Thanks again for coming on with us. And quick clarification, is it .com or .io?
It's either, you know, it's technology. Okay. You'll get there.
All right. It's all a mirror. All right. Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thank you.
My name is Sam Brownback. I'm former ambassador for religious freedom, former senator and governor. And I really work a lot now on religious freedom. I'm the co-chair of the International Religious Freedom Summit and the chairman of the National Committee for Religious Freedom. And you're listening to Mill Creek View podcast. Thanks for joining us. I don't
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard quickly. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, COO and co-founder, GetHedge.io, Paul Bradley?
Oh, man. I learned a lot. I wrote down lots of notes, and I've got a lot of research to do. But I know about my little pinky, the fingernail on my little pinky is about all I know about this stuff. My sons know more about this than I do, but thanks for bringing him on. I'd like to bring that guy on. I've got a lot of questions I will send your way next time, Steve.
Yeah, well, two episodes in, we should know a little bit more than a pinky, but okay, better than nothing. Got a comment to read from Fan of Stories on iTunes. This show is always informative and fun. The guests who span across politics, health, sports, and more are always so interesting and bring a fresh perspective to the news of the day. Thanks, Fan of Stories. We try. It's all about the guests. Glad you see that. Okay, Producer Steve-O, let's get into this. It was a long month of news in March, and here we are, first show of April. I like to think of our show as doing some good out there, opening some eyes and making a positive impact, like we say when we introduce the show's guests, but I'm not so sure. Let's start with this clip, a montage that they say in the 80s movies.
Articles of impeachment.
Impeach him first and then indict him.
Yes, the president, a sitting president, can be indicted.
Even if the president were to somehow find some way to terminate Mueller, the indictments would continue to grind.
You could impeach anybody on anything. You can try and indict.
He is not functioning as the president of the United States. Frankly, if he ever gets indicted, he'll have insanity as a defense, I suppose, from a criminal charge. But it's hardly, you know, this is a serious matter.
You're starting to hear people talk about the possibility that Donald Trump leaves office in 2 years and then finds himself in the crosshairs of these New York prosecutors.
This sitting president can and should be indicted.
President, there for sure is more than likely going to serve some jail time.
It's clear that Trump is the target and he'll be indicted eventually.
On the day Donald Trump leaves office, the Justice Department may indict him.
Now there is talk of jail time for the president.
That Mueller could indict the president for obstruction of justice.
Donald Trump should be indicted for calling a cooperating witness a rat.
He should have been indicted.
The sitting president can be indicted by the Justice Department.
Why aren't we at the target, Trump, having committed crimes to get the presidency? So why aren't we at an indictment yet?
I think there's generally consensus that the president has probably committed indictable crimes.
It's very strongly in favor of indicting the president when he is out of office.
That there may be enough evidence to indict Trump.
Is Donald Trump going to be indicted?
Maybe it'll happen. Maybe he'll go to prison.
Will he ever see the inside of a prison cell?
DA could get a ham sandwich indicted. Hey, listen, Trump's the Big Mac.
Even if Donald Trump himself is not ever indicted, there is another way that prosecutors can actually indict the entire Trump org.
We hope that the Attorney General sees the importance of moving ahead with this indictment, moving ahead with locking Steve Bannon up.
The whole enchilada, the whole company, indicted by next week.
Why not pursue it?
2022.
And see what happens.
Merrick Garland, if you indict Trump, you'll be my person of the year, of the decade.
The only thing worse than indicting him would be not indicting him.
Would be folly not to indict them.
Donald Trump is an ordinary citizen and is committing crimes right now.
I like the idea of Mark Meadows going to jail for the rest of his life, but I still think that the committee has laid out that the person on top of all of this, in charge of all of this, doing all of this, was Donald Trump.
Think now for him not to indict,
frankly, would cause this country more harm than even if he indicts and there's a hung jury or not a successful conviction.
I think there should be no case in which they wouldn't indict.
I don't think we should be treating him the way other ex-presidents were treated.
I think the extent of what Donald Trump's done is so egregious that no attorney general, no fair-minded attorney general would have any choice.
According to The Atlantic, Garland is preparing to indict Trump despite moving at the cautious pace of an institutionalist.
The only reasons Trump hasn't been indicted by now is because he's a former president and because he has handpicked judges on his side.
Accountability for some people means that we get a pound of flesh from Donald Trump and that he ends up behind bars.
Don't you think it's about time for special counsel Jack Smith to just indict Trump?
And would such a move take Trump off the campaign trail?
Is this the charge you would want him to be indicted on? What did
Steve, they have a saying that if you say a lie long enough and often enough, people will believe it.
That's right. Former president, number 45, the Teflon Don, years of mainstream media pushing Trump indictment hysteria, finally indicted him today. Well, like the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, they never stop trying. Maybe this time the walls will finally close in. I wonder if they'll now do this with every ex-president going forward. I thought they might with impeachment, but I don't hear that moving forward against Biden. Clip number two, please.
Proposed budget proposes $4.7 trillion in new taxes.
It does propose significant additional taxes, yes.
$4.7 trillion?
Something like that, yes.
Oh.
So that was Senator Kennedy from Louisiana and Treasury Secretary Janet Kangaroo, Captain Kangaroo haircut Yellen. They're looting the Treasury while destroying what's left of this country, and I have no idea who doesn't see it at this point. What are Americans supposed to do when corruption concretes itself into the highest levels of our media, our government, and our justice system? Any ideas, Steve?
Well, I told somebody this morning in a text that we have a criminal syndicate that runs our government, and welcome to, many countries all over the world. We have now arrived at
Tin pot dictatorship, yes. And that means that our exceptionalism is gone. Okay, well, if our money isn't safe, at least our military is the strongest in the world, right? Let's hear clip number three.
That influenced my appreciation for how diversity and inclusion drives better outcomes. In my last job, we planned to release a report on aerospace and defense in the year 2050, and I wanted to do it at South by Southwest, the nation's largest technology and innovation festival. To reach that type of educated, creative workforce at South by, we needed to compete for attention with consumer-facing brands that often spent millions to launch their products or TV shows. I thought we could get noticed by giving away cool swag alongside the report, and my idea was branded socks. We spent some time debating the color of the socks, the logo, and just how many to order. And just before finalizing the plan, a young woman on my team came in and asked if she could speak to me privately. She confided, "Alex, you know women don't really wear crew socks." I asked, "Well, what do they wear?" And she responded, "Ankle socks." It had never occurred to me to order any other kind of socks than the kind that I was familiar with. Her suggestion had merit, and we ended up ordering half ankle and half crew socks. Of course, the socks were a hit. But what was telling was that demand for the ankle socks by both women and men was higher than for the crew socks, and substantially so. Our entire project was more effective because a woman on my team was comfortable sharing her perspective with a pretty opinionated male boss, and that I was open to that input. Intentionally building a diverse team and then creating an environment where everyone feels like their voices are valued and heard is not only the right thing to do, but it gets you better outcomes.
The American military of Andrew Jackson and Douglas MacArthur devolves into a Pentagon diversity weenie talking about socks for girls. I wonder why young men don't want to enlist. Last week, I read the headline, state-sanctioned kidnapping. California bill would give therapists power to take children over 12 from parents without accusation, evidence, or trial. The proposed bill would allow a mental health professional to place a child as young as 12 in a residential shelter facility without parental knowledge or consent and without there being any prior allegations of incest or child abuse. I don't make this stuff up. Clip number four, please.
I am Sage's mother.
There. Okay, you're right.
Better known as Nana. I adopted Sage after my son died when she was still a baby. She's been through 6 foster homes by then, but we loved her, and she blossomed into a joyful, lively girl who made music and art. Puberty began, and COVID hit, and she was treated for depression and anxiety, at times very severe. Her teachers shared any concerns with me so her treatment could be adapted. The transparency ended in August of 2021 when Sage started high school. She started a public high school, and she told me that all the girls there were bi, trans, lesbian, emo, and she wanted to wear boys' clothes and be emo. Because I saw it as just a phase, it was fine with me. But at school, she told them something different. She was now a boy named Brooke Draco with male pronouns. Sage asked the school not to tell me, and they did not tell me, even though I informed them of her mental health history and medication. If I had known, this would be a much different story. She was terribly bullied. No one told me, but boys followed her, touched her, threatened violence and rape. Something happened in the boys' bathroom, but for 2 days, the school told me nothing. They kept meeting with Sage alone, and she became so distraught, they called me to pick her up. That evening, I found a hall pass labeled Draco, and Sage told me she was identifying as a boy and that her counselor said she could use the boys' bathroom. She'd been jacked up against the wall by a group of boys. She was crying, terrified. I said, just stay home, we'll figure it out. That was my last conversation with Sage for 5 months. The night she ran, she thought to a young friend she'd met online. She left a note saying she was scared of what would happen if she stayed. The sheriff, FBI, search dogs were called in. I dropped to my knees in prayer.
Okay.
The stated purpose of AB 665, introduced by Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo, is to bring two existing laws into alignment. Currently, children age 12 are over 12 and over are able to consent to receiving mental health treatment or counseling services, but cannot consent to being placed into a residential shelter facility unless deemed either a risk to themselves or others, or in cases where the minor is an alleged victim of incest or child abuse. AB 665 seeks to remove these caveats. According to the CDC, the suicide rates have increased by 11% for those 24 and younger since 2011, the year the law went into effect. Instead of repealing a bill that has not helped our youth, California is doubling down and further eroding parents' role in their child's life, according to Aaron Friday, co-lead of Our Duty. The bill will give counselors unfettered control over children age 12 and above. In 2010, former Governor Schwarzenegger signed Family Code 6924, which gave children age 12 and over the ability to obtain mental health counseling without parental consent. The aim was to prevent youth suicide, but according to Friday, it has failed. Removing loving parents from the children's lives will not help them, she said. Certainly makes headlines. This makes sense, right? More than 500,000 flee California since 2020. They're no longer California dreaming. More than 500,000 people fled the Golden State since 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic began. U.S. Census migration data shows the exodus of roughly 508,000 residents between April 2020 and July 2022 was spurred by high housing prices, frequent natural disasters like wildfires and mudslides, and high crime rates in the cities, the Daily Mail reported. The largest population declines were in San Francisco County at 7.1% and Lassen County at 7.5%. Lassen County in Northwest California was hit by massive Dixie wildfire in 2021. Clip number five, please.
Oh, geez. Sorry about the noise, folks. I got somebody literally banging on the outside of the building. They're putting in new siding. And let me try to get this thing fixed. It was going good, Steve, and then the Twitter thing did it again. It started spinning. So here we go.
You have a parent's bill of rights now. This says the parent can now know what's being taught in the school. This is now saying the parents can now look at the reading material. It's now saying the parents can now see what the money is being spent on. It's now saying that the parents can protect their kids' privacy. It now says the parents can have a notification if there's any violent activity on campus. But unfortunately, the Democrats are too extreme to believe that parents should have a say in their kids' education.
That's what it's come down to. We have a parent's bill of rights. Number one, right to know what's being taught in school and see reading materials. Number two, right to be heard. Three, right to see school budgets and spending. Four, right to protect your child's privacy. Five, right to be notified of any violent activity at school. Seems reasonable. Thomas Massey from Michigan tweeted out, if the Bill of Rights didn't exist, and if I were to offer those amendments on the floor of the House today, most Democrats would vote no on the Bill of Rights. No Democrat would vote for the Second Amendment. Few would vote for the First, Fourth, Ninth, or Tenth Amendments as worded. Thought that was pretty good. Well, they certainly can use that in Oregon. Check this out. Father demands teacher and high school football coach Kirk Miller be fired after providing sexual fantasies assignment to children at Churchill High School in Eugene, Oregon. Go ahead.
So I am here to discuss this atrocity of assignments. I want to first say you're a liar. It's not a rumor. I have the proof right here in my phone of the whom would you do it with? And my daughter specifically stated that the teacher put up a wheel on the class board and it stated anal penetration, oral sex, licking of ear, kissing, and he wanted them to write down the initials of a boy or girl that they would do these activities with. Now, I don't know what's worse, wanting to know my child's sexual fantasy or who they're going to have anal penetration and oral sex with. What is he gaining from this? What do you gain from this information? Why has my daughter that naively did the assignment? Because she's scared. She wants to get good grades. She wants to be, you know, get her license. She has to get good grades. And so she does this assignment. Where's the assignment? Why hasn't she had it turned back to her with her grade on it? What is he doing with it? Is this for his spank bank? Is he literally using this for his sexual deviant? These are questions that need to be answered. He verbally abused, verbally, sexually abused every single child in that classroom. You look up the definition. I gave you the paper for the definition of verbal sexual abuse. Now, sexual abuse is sexual abuse. So where's the criminal charges? Why is he still teaching? Is it because he's the football coach and Churchill's doing good? Don't want to lose that hype? Because football doesn't matter when it comes to our children. Okay? This sexual deviant needs to be removed. If you do not remove him, I am giving you my word today that tomorrow morning I will go down to the county clerk's office and I will file for the removal of every single one of you.
Yes! Keep an eye on that.
Wow.
Go ahead. What do you got to say?
If I had a coach like that, I don't think the guy would live very long. What can I say?
Yeah, Coach Kirk Miller, Churchill High School in Eugene, Oregon. Oh, and don't send your kids to Stanford Law School if you want them to get a job to pay off those massive loans anytime soon. Federal judges, plural, say they won't hire clerks from Stanford Law School. James Ho and Elizabeth Branch, who announced a clerkship boycott of Yale Law last year, are adding Stanford to the list. Ho and Branch, who introduced Ho at the Texas Review event, are two of 14 federal judges boycotting Yale Law School over a rash of high-profile free speech scandals, including an incident last month in which hundreds of students disrupted Kristen Wagoner, a religious liberty lawyer who has won several cases at the Supreme Court. Imagine that every judge who says they're opposed to discrimination at Yale and Stanford takes the same path, Ho said. Imagine they decide that until the discrimination stops, they will no longer hire from those schools in the future. How quickly do you think those schools would stop discriminating then? Good job, Ho and Branch. Not just Stanford, of course. March may be over, but college madness continues. Congratulations, Connecticut. Several former and current members of the sorority at the University of Wyoming, Cowboys, have filed a lawsuit after a man who identified as a woman was permitted to join. Even former and current members of Kappa Kappa Gamma at UW filed the lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for Wyoming, asking the court to void the membership of Artemis Langford, a 21-year-old male who claims to be female, identified in the lawsuit as Terry Smith. Langford gained admittance to KKG last fall, even as other pledges and sorority sisters felt uncomfortable with having a man in their all-female organization. Nah, come on. It's just a troubled he-she. There's also considerable evidence that Langford is heterosexual. That is, that he is sexually attracted to women. He has created a Tinder profile seeking female matches. He was also reportedly caught watching one unsuspecting woman wearing only a towel walk toward the communal bathroom to take a shower. Other KKG members claim that Langford has become noticeably aroused when he watched women enter the sorority house. Oh, well, must be a mental health issue. Call a guidance counselor. Who could have ever seen this coming? Me. But it is mostly Stanford. Stanford goes all in on diversity. 2023 surgical team includes zero white men. Stanford's 2023 surgical team, 92% women. U.S. happens to be 50% women. 69% non-white. U.S. is 38% non-white. 0% white men. U.S. is 30% white men. Suggesting the university is accepting candidates based off of their race or gender. Oh, and Tyrion Steinbeck, remember her from last week, the fired associate professor there that mansplained to the federal judge and got fired, wrote an op-ed to the Wall Street Journal for some reason. We have to stop blaming, start listening, and ask ourselves, is the juice worth the squeeze? She's sticking with that line, I guess. Squeeze that juice. Regardless of where you stand politically, none of this heated exchange was helpful for civil discourse or productive dialogue. I guess that counts as an apology. Also counts in her paycheck. Clip number six.
Oh, we got another clip, Steve.
Last one, actually, yeah.
Is this the...
He's out. He's getting out of there. And who's coming in his place? Who's coming in his place, you ask? Jeff Zients. Who's Jeff Zients? So you're getting rid of a longtime Biden advisor, and they're bringing back in Jeff Zients. Jeff Zients is Bain Capital. Yeah, that's right. The same Bain Capital as Mitt Romney. Jeff Zients is a Wall Street guy, but he's always been a Wall Street guy who was aligned with the left. This is how the Uniparty works, by the way. They have one firm, Bain Capital, and they have a guy who says he's on the right, like Mitt Romney, and then a guy who says he's on the left, like Jeff Zients. But really, they're all the same group of people. They're the Uniparty. This is how Wall Street works. This is how the establishment works. So this guy Zients, who's he close to? Former President Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now the Uniparty is coming back and they're taking over the reins of the White House. Ron Klain sees the writing on the wall. Because what's going on over this past weekend? More and more documents coming to light. Do you really believe me, or do you expect me to believe? Do you really expect me to believe that all of a sudden they just found these documents out of nowhere? Like, oh, whoops, we just woke up one day and found out that there were classified documents over there somewhere. No. Cut the crap. There's a reason the establishment and the regime is turning on President Biden. Rush Limbaugh, believe it or not, actually predicted that this would happen. Now, he said it would be about the laptop, not necessarily about classified documents, but that's not the point. He predicted that eventually you would see, this is Rush, not even me, you would see former President Obama using leverage to undercut President Biden from inside the White House, and that they would be using this to reestablish a path for a new candidate to come into office. Who's that candidate, you ask? Well, I'll tell you something. It ain't Kamala Harris. So what I've been told, and this is what we got from our White House official, our White House staffer. Let's just go into it, because I asked, I said, what's going on with the shade war? Can you give us some background? Here are the notes. It's a madhouse. Nobody trusts each other in the slightest anymore. Advisors have been pointing fingers over leaks, and staffers loyal to those respective advisors have subsequently split into factions. The shade war as a conventional conflict is over. People on both sides are still conducting smear jobs, but it's mostly uncoordinated and carried out by extreme loyalists. Other than that, the White House has dissolved into a battle royale.
All right, yeah. That was a bonus clip. I don't even know why I put it in there, but it's pretty good, I thought. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden can't talk to each other. The country's a mess. It's fish rotting from the head down, as you say. But I did want to conclude on, do you wonder why, Steve, we haven't heard much from BLM since the Summer of Love, back when they burned cities over George Floyd?
Yeah, I have been wondering that exact thing. Why haven't we?
Well, this headline says a lot. Struggle for control of the Black Lives Matter organization heads to court. A judge tentatively rejected a bid to dismiss a lawsuit brought by Black Lives Matter grassroots against the Black Lives Matter Global Network on anti-SLAPP slap grounds. Hillel Aaron. The internecine struggle for control of the Black Lives Matter organization spilled into a Los Angeles courtroom on Wednesday for arguments on a motion to dismiss a lawsuit against the current leadership on free speech grounds. The lawsuit filed in Los Angeles County Superior Court in September 2022 accuses the head of the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, Shlomia Bowers, of using the world-famous organization as his personal piggy bank by siphoning off more than $10 million from donors, as well as stealing control of the organizations through a series of misrepresentations and unauthorized backroom dealings. BLM really stands for Buy Large Mansions. That'll do it. Stay tuned for my thought of the day. Welcome to my quotes for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, go ahead and leave a comment. And thanks for doing it. If you can't fly, then run. If you can't run, then walk. If you can't walk, then crawl. But whatever you do, you have to keep moving forward. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Last one. May I stress the need for courageous, intelligent, and dedicated leadership, leaders of sound integrity, leaders not in love with publicity, but in love with justice, leaders not in love with money, but in love with humanity. Leaders who can subject their particular egos to the greatness of the cause. Martin Luther King Jr. said all that. The King family and others believe that the assassination was the result of a conspiracy involving the U.S. government, the mafia, and Memphis police. They believe that James Earl Ray was a scapegoat. In 1999, the family filed a wrongful death lawsuit for the sum of $10 million. During closing arguments, their attorney asked the jury to award damages of $100 to make the point that it was not about the money. During the trial, both sides presented evidence alleging a government conspiracy. Based on the evidence, the jury concluded there was a conspiracy to kill King and awarded the family $100. That's it for this episode. Really hope you liked it. A little longer than usual, but I hope you liked it. Thank you, Paul Bradley, for keeping on and keeping an eye on the store of value so we don't starve. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
At the county fair, they were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder. Lord, I love the land where I was born.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.